TalkZone.com.
TalkZone presents the Geek Speak Radio Show with your hosts, Henry and Romo. Your top spot for everything entertainment and pop culture, including TV, movies, comics, casting news, and more. Now, here are your hosts, Henry and Romo.
And we're back on the Geek Speak Radio Show. Hello there. Hey, Romo.
Hey.
How's it going?
Doing great.
Fantastic.
Talking about comic books soon.
Yes.
I know. I can't wait to actually go to this website. And
yeah, like I said, this show, I realized that over the weekend,
yeah,
just for giggles, not scary giggles, nervous giggles like yours, but just for giggles, I was listening to all the archive shows that we have.
Yeah.
And they're all up on TalkZone.com if you guys want to listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to them, and I noticed that this show is a lot like going to a convention, like WonderCon, Comic-Con, New York Comic-Con just happened a few weeks ago. You don't know, unless you look at the calendar on the website, you really don't know what you're gonna get.
Yeah.
Like 1 minute you'll be talking about Halloween stuff, the next minute you're talking about comics, then a movie, then Chloe Moretz comes in, then Rod Roddenberry's here, and then David Glanzer's here, then we're talking amongst us about what are our favorite movies.
Yeah, and then we're talking about House of Shock, and it's like, it goes everywhere, and that's what I like about it. You get a taste of everything. Everything from pop culture, that's what's happening in televisions, movie, comic books. It's great.
Yeah. And then unexpectedly, we're talking about the Paul Dini, about his new show. And then we talk about video games, Arkham Asylum, and all the Batman animated stories that he did.
Yeah.
So very cool. Yeah, and biased, of course, but I like this show.
Yeah, I like this show too.
Yeah. So, like I said, we did all Halloween, a lot of scary stuff, starting with the House of Shock on last hour. Then we talked Paranormal Activity 2, very spoiler-filled review. If you guys go on there and listen to it, there are spoilers, so you've been warned.
Yeah. Man.
But the consensus is, from not just from us, everybody that went to see it, they loved it. Everybody's happy with this sequel.
Yeah, I know, me too.
Which is a good thing, because usually it doesn't work out that way. The sequels usually are weaker than the original that it came from.
Yeah, it's kind of
not in this case.
Well, I mean, it's clever writing. Great. I mean, this movie boils down to great writing.
Yeah, and I got to say, I was, I think I talked about it on the show, in fact, but I think that when the sequel was announced, immediately after Paranormal Activity 2 became the monster hit that it was.
Yeah.
The sequel was greenlit, moving ahead. Orin Peli, the director, he couldn't come back because it was just so soon and there were other things on his schedule. He came back as producer for this one, and I thought right away, the fact that it's not the same team, that's going to hurt it. But it didn't.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, like I said, it does make the original that much better.
Yeah.
Now you see it in a completely different light.
I do.
The Elaviata, you know what I mean, because you all went to see it. So, like I said, now, how about we talk comic books?
Nice.
More specifically, comic art.
That's what I love comics for, is the artwork. That's why I collect. I mean, that's why I love X-Men, I love Spider-Man. It's the artwork itself that we all buy comics for.
You do collect them, right?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so does Mike Burke, actually. He has a website called RomitaMan.com. And yes, if you're a real comic book fan, you recognize that name.
Yes.
He's that's not his last name. You know John
Romita.
The Romitas.
Yeah, we do.
Senior engineer, junior. So let's talk to Mike about his collection. So Mike, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
Doing great. So, yes, start telling the, first of all, let me ask you actually, when did your interest in not collecting the art, but collecting comics themselves, when did that start?
Yeah, I was about 11 or 12 and, growing up in Cleveland, Ohio. And, interestingly, back then, didn't have money, never got allowances. And I told my dad, a friend of mine in sixth grade showed me his comic book collection. He had about 300 comic books and he invited me over to his house and he was telling me all about Flash, Superman, Spider-Man, he battles this villain, this issue, this villain, and I just got hooked. And my dad goes, well, if you want to collect comics, get a job. So I delivered papers for 3 cents a paper, and that's how I started collecting comics.
What were some of your favorites? Favorite titles, I mean?
Oh, Spider-Man, Hulk, and Avengers, I would say, were the three books I read the most. Those were my favorites. And Iron Man.
Yeah. Yeah, mine were always...
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, growing up, I used to love this TV show called... A lot of people that probably are under 40 probably never heard of it. It's called Ultraman. And I loved Ultraman and Johnny Sacco as a kid. And Iron Man always reminded me of Ultraman, so I always got into Iron Man because of that.
Yeah, I actually remember that show. I'm I'm almost in my 40s, not quite yet, but almost there. Yeah, but I remember that one. I was going to say my favorite title was, I've always been a Spider-Man guy, but I also like, you know, the Avengers, Fantastic Four, X-Men, all the other ones also. But Spider-Man has always been my favorite. When did you start collecting the comic book art?
Yeah, I started collecting comic art. You know, there was a big magazine used to be called the Comics Buyer's Guide, you know, years before the internet and everything, where you could always buy comics and everything. And back in end of 1989 was when I bought my first piece of comic art. Oddly enough, it was a John Romita Sr. page from Spider-Man issue 46, a four-panel battle page of Spider-Man battling the Shocker, and I paid $100 for it back then, which at the time, which I didn't know, I actually found out that was actually a high price at the time for it. But that was the first piece of artwork I got in, and I had no idea what it would look like, the size or anything, but the day I got it in, a little light bulb went off in my head, and I said, oh, man. I said, this is the future. I said, comic books are cool, but this is the stuff that's going to be worth something one day. And it's held true.
Yeah, most people that would have found that, like, for example, me, I would have probably kept it for myself. What made you want to sell it? Because it is a John Romita, after all.
No, I bought it. That was my first page I bought.
Yeah, I'm saying, but when somebody gets those, what would make them want to sell it? Because that's what it's going to lead to.
Well, interestingly, well, obviously, if you need money, but most people, I found out that when I started collecting, most people collect, and I always said, wow, I said, you know, some people would have a Spider-Man page that I want, and I said, well, I don't want to sell it, I collect, so I had to buy the stuff and try to find the stuff that I don't collect so that I could trade them, so that's what I found out, that I had to buy stuff that I don't collect so that I could trade other people for the stuff I do collect for the Spider-Man art. They would say, like, get me an X-Men page or a Fantastic Four page, and I'll trade you my Romita Spider-Man page, but I don't want to sell it. So that's what happened to me. But I said, doggone it. I said, I gotta find out the market on the stuff I don't collect so that I could trade these people for the stuff I do collect. So that's how I sort of got into it pretty hot and heavy, getting into the artwork.
Okay, and again, we're talking to Mike Berge. He's from RomitaMan.com. The website is linked up on GeekSpeakGetAShow.com. You guys can go on there. I'm going to take a break right now. Go on there, take a look at the art. Romo is over there. We're going to take a look at the art. When we come back, we'll talk more about the website itself. Don't go anywhere.
This is the Geek Speak Radio Show Buzz Report for Monday, October 25th. Here's what's buzzing right now. Tony Scott and Jerry Bruckheimer will be turned to direct and produce Top Gun 2. Tony confirmed this to HitFlix over the weekend and said he'd like to examine the end of the fighter pilot and focus more on the modern Air Force, which he describes as computer geeks who can fly unmanned drones a world away from the comfort of their home and then party all night. No confirmation on Tom Cruise's involvement in the sequel. Danny DeVito will voice the title character in Universal Pictures and Illumination Entertainment's the adaptation of Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. The voices of Zac Efron, Betty White, Ed Helms, and Rob Riggle will also be in the 3D animated movie. Paranormal Activity 2 easily won the weekend box office with $41.5 million, which makes it the highest opening ever for a supernatural horror movie. Jackass 3D came in second with $21 million and Red at the number 3 spot with $15 million. Clint Eastwood's Hereafter managed a disappointing fourth-place finish with $12 million earned for the weekend. Today's Hobbit news, this is going to become a regular feature on the show. The battle between Warner Brothers and the Australian Media, Entertainment and Art Alliance has put the production at a standstill and will most likely result in a movie being filmed elsewhere. Warner Brothers execs are visiting New Zealand today to make a final decision on whether the production stays in New Zealand or goes elsewhere. Rallies are being held all over New Zealand hoping for an end to the dispute and for the production to film there. New Zealander Hunter Abbey has created a pretty cool video mixing images from the rallies with dialogue from the Lord of the Rings films. Check it out at GeekSpeakRadioShow.com and come back tomorrow to see what the outcome of today's meeting was. That's what's buzzing right now, and that's the GeekSpeak Radio Show Buzz Report.
GeekSpeak Radio Show will be right back.
Right, are we ready?
Yeah!
The real reason for the invention of the internet. TalkZone.com.
Transmit.
And now, back to the Geek Speak Radio Show on TalkZone.com. Here's Henry and Romo.
Hello, welcome back to Geek Speak Radio Show, talking comic books, comic art. Talking to Mike Berger from RomitaMan.com. The links are up on GeekSpeakRadioShow.com. You guys can go out there. I told you, Romo actually did it. He printed a few. I told you guys to go on there and take a look at some of the art that he has for sale and trade. Mike, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
There you are. So when did you create, when did you create the website, RomitaMan.com?
Back in 2003. I was on another friend's website for a little bit, but I started that website back in 2003 with a local friend who was my webmaster who helped me get it all set up.
But you decided to call it RomitaMan.
Yeah, it's sort of neat. Well, believe it or not, other people kept calling me that. I would, you know, before the internet, I would go to conventions like the Chicago Comic Con and the Motor City Comic Con and San Diego Comic Con, and I'd set up with Armin, and people would say, "Who are you?" And I told them my name, and they'd look through my art, and they'd go, "Oh, you're the Romita guy. You're the guy that has all the Romita art. You're the Romita man." And I thought, you know what? I said, that's a neat name for a website. Plus, I'm such close friends with John Romita Sr., and junior, but more senior. And I just said, you know what, Romita Man, that's almost like a comic book name, you know, a superhero name. So I said, Romita Man. I said, when the internet came about, I said, that's what I'm going to call my website and homage to my friend. So it all worked out.
Yeah. And tell us what we can find on RomitaMan.com. I told everybody to go on there. And again, the links are up on GeekSpeakRadioShow.com. But Mike, you tell us what can we find on RomitaMan.com?
Yeah. I have about 2,000 to 3,000, art images of art, and I give pretty good descriptions of what they are. A lot of people don't do that. I try to give real good descriptions so people can understand, you know, what's on the page and what they're buying and things like that. But again, you know, the neat thing about comic art is that it's all one of a kind, you know. I always used to tell people that. I said, you know what, if you collect and comic books are fine because we all are, every comic art collector is a comic book collector first, of course, because it's a nostalgia thing. But I always tell people, you know, like when I first started collecting, I said, you know, a comic book is a color Xerox of this one-of-a-kind original. And I said, when you have it, you have the only one in the world. And I said, you know, I bet in the future, when I first started collecting, I said, you know, these things are going to be worth something one day because there's no price guides for it or anything like that, like comic books. So basically the market sort of dictates it. But I always tell everybody, you have to collect it because you love it, not because it has value or anything like that. But, you know, and the stuff, the art has gone up, you know, exponentially since when I first started collecting. I mean, you know, Spider-Man pages, I used to pay $40. I never paid over $100 a page for years for Romita Spider-Man page. And now, you know, they go for between like $5,000 and $20,000 a piece now. And, you know, and everybody says, how did you know to collect that? I said, I knew to collect it because it was the cheapest stuff out there. I couldn't afford anything when I got out of the Army. And it's just grown. Like I said, the auction houses, you know, Sotheby's and Christie's were the first two places to have auction houses where everybody in the world could bid on these things. And that's when prices started going up exponentially. And then when the internet came about, you know, that broadened the horizons for everybody all over the world to be able to see these things. And that's how they went from sort of a novelty collectible to, you know, art that's in, you know, museums now. So.
Yeah, I think the movies that have been coming out made them more iconic and that let people see that, oh, hey, this actually could be worth something. So do you get just comic book collectors or is it from all walks of life now?
It's all comic book collectors because, sadly, in some way, the hobby is almost an expensive hobby. It's impossible for somebody off the street to just get in the hobby and really, you know, buy a lot of the high-end things. But I always tell people, you know, the next new artist that might be selling artwork for $25, $50, $100 a page, you know, they could be the next, you know, the next Todd McFarlane guy where his stuff is, you know, through the roof or things like that. So, you know, but it's a fun hobby. And like I said, like I said before, you always have to buy the stuff you enjoy and the stuff you like because it's a hobby. But unfortunately, it's a high-end hobby now because the artwork has gotten so valuable over the past, you know, 15, 20 years that nobody could have ever perceived, and nor I, but it's quite amazing. So.
Yeah, and again, we're talking to Mike Berkey from RomitaMan.com. The links are up on GeekSpeakRadioShow.com, so you guys can go on there and take a look at some of the art that he has. Mike, what was it like meeting, well, you said it's a friend of yours, but what was it like meeting John Romita Sr.?
Yeah, it was great. Well, I first met him, I actually had a comic book store, me and my older brother. He did the sports cards and I did the comics, and we opened up a comic shop, sports card shop, back in 1991. And I met John Romita and Stan Lee in 1992, for the first time at a sales conference, a comic book sales conference in Wisconsin. And it was great. It was like I said, I liken it to like a movie buff meeting their favorite actor, you know? Like yeah. If you're a Nicolas Cage fan or something like that, just meeting him in person at a show, it's like you're in awe. And took a bunch of pictures with him, you know, and it was the greatest. And just from corresponding throughout the years, we ended up becoming really good friends. And I visit him once, twice a year, usually in New York. And we become really good friends. And he actually flew to Ohio in 2008 to visit me. And I wanted him to meet my family because I said we were such close friends. I wanted him to meet my family. And he came out for my dad's birthday party. And we had a great time. It was a lot of fun. And a lot of friends came to meet him.
How'd you meet Junior?
Just through Dad. Believe it or not, a lot of times I would meet John Senior, and John Junior would be over at the house. And plus, I always would set up at a comic book convention in New York City, and John Senior and John Junior would come. So I got to meet John Junior through his dad.
Okay.
And he's a great guy too. Him and his wife and his son, and I know all of them really well. They're great people.
And on the website on RomitaMan.com, do you sell them? Do you trade them? Or what do you do on RomitaMan.com?
I mostly sell. Well, I collect the Spider-Man stuff. So I basically how it all got started was, again, just collecting Spider-Man art and me realizing that I couldn't just buy art from other people that had artwork. I had to try to trade them for the art. So I started buying the stuff I didn't collect, then just kept building and building and building. And so I pretty much sell everything but the stuff in my core collection. But on the website, I do have a section there where it says Mike's Collection Gallery. And there's probably 300, 400, 500 John Romita Spider-Man pages on there. I really don't have prices on them, but I have sold some pages. Some people say, oh, I got to have a page from this issue. It's the first book I ever read. And if we could work it out, I work it out. And I'm not going to lie. If I could sell it for, you know, if I get a price, that's a good price. And I said, okay, this is worth it to me. Then I'll do it. Because I always say, you know, you can't take it with you when you go. So I have a lot of it. So if some people offer me a good price, I do sell things or trade things from my collection.
Yeah. Do you buy from people who may have collections?
Oh, all the time. Uh-huh. Yeah, I wheel and deal in everything, but I just collect the Spider-Man for myself. But I buy, I probably get in 5-10 packages every week, and I'm sending out 5-10 packages every week of artwork. So I buy a lot.
And if somebody listening right now has a collection that they want you to look at, how do they contact you? On the website or how?
Yeah, on the website, they can give me a phone call or contact me on the website. My home email just on the website also. And I talk to people all the time from all over the world, actually. And it's interesting now that Europe is like a huge market for comic book art. I would probably say 10 years ago, maybe 5 to 10% of all the artwork I sell and trade was in Europe. Now it's probably close to 25%. So the European market, and you know, I have there's collectors in Asia, there's collectors in Singapore, collectors in Australia that contact me all the time that are regular customers. So
hey, Mike, it's Romo.
Mm-hmm.
I love the site. I've been looking at all the artwork. I spent the whole hour of just amazed at your collection. I wanted to know what's your most prized art pieces that you have personally that you have in your collection.
Yeah, my prize things are, well, a lot of people in the artwork hobby know there's a thing called, they call it large art or twice up art. Up until 1967, the art was drawn on a much bigger board, like a 14 by 20 roughly board, but the art image was roughly 12 by 18 inches. And those were called twice up or large art. Those, to me, are the most coveted art pieces. And after that, the art images were 10 by 15 inches. So you'll see people say twice up or large art. And so John Romita, Spider-Man, just from knowing the collecting, Spider-Man issue 53 was the last issue that they drew on what they call the large art boards. So John Romita's first issue was issue 39. So for me personally, the issues between issues 39 and 53 are my most coveted because 20 pages to an issue, 15 issues. So there's only 300 large art John Romita Spider-Man pages in existence of the oversized pages. So those are the ones that I covet the most. I have a couple of them. I think two of them pictured on the website in the Spider-Man gallery from issue, I think, 43 and 53 that I had picked up. But those are the ones I covet the most. And I don't have those pictured yet on my website, but I am. I'm trying to go up in order. But all my Spider-Man pages, I think from issues 55 to 84, I think I have pictured on the website. So,
that's nice. I was wondering. Yeah. My favorite is actually Wolverine Limited Edition, the number one. I was wondering if you know anyone that has that one, or do you have it yourself?
The Wolverine Limited Edition. Now, when you're saying the, you mean like the miniseries he had had?
Yeah, the series, yeah. Number one. That's one of my favorite art pieces, the cover.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to think. Was it Mike Zeck, I think, that drew? I'm not sure who drew the cover to those.
Yeah,
you're talking about like art pages to it.
Yeah,
that's great stuff. I know the early Zeck stuff goes for a lot of money. You know, he did the Punisher miniseries.
Yeah, it's actually worth like $270 just for the comic book in good conditions. But yeah, great stuff. Love the website.
Right, and you know, as you know, John Romita created the Wolverine costume. You know, the character, he drew the first ever drawings of Wolverine also.
Yeah, are there any pieces, perfect. Mike, that you yourself are looking for, specific pieces of art that you don't have that you're looking for?
Always. Well, like I said, I actually collect from issue 39 to 297 of Amazing Spider-Man. That's sort of my collecting range. Again, when I first started collecting, it's sort of funny. The McFarlane stuff was going for more than the Romita stuff, so I said, okay, I don't want that. It's too expensive. And then the Ditko stuff was 10, 20 times higher than Romita artwork, so I said, okay, I don't want that. So when I first started collecting, I said, okay, I collect from issue 39 to 297, because that was all the stuff at the time when I first started collecting, when I was in my early 20s, that I could afford. So that's sort of what I collect. But primarily the John Romita era of Spider-Man, which is basically Spidey 39 to 125. I collect basically any pages from any of those issues was always my motto back then. And I've actually completed several books, gotten the whole 20-page books throughout the years just from meeting people and collecting and piecing them together. I always say it's sort of like an archaeologist finding an archaeological find. And you find a bone here, a bone there, a bone there, and if you keep going long enough, you know, you complete the skeleton. So, but Spidey 46, you know, that page I told you earlier where I got my first piece of artwork from, issue 46 with the Shocker. Last year I actually completed the book. A guy in New York City had the page one splash page, and I had pages 2 through 20, and I did a deal on it last year and completed that book. And then about 8 years ago, Spider-Man, I don't know if you remember those drug issues where he battles the Green Goblin, Spider-Man 96, 97, 98.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very classic storylines that were not approved by the Comics Code Authority because they talked about Harry Osborn being on drugs and stuff. And
yeah.
And Spidey 98, I completed that one a couple years ago, all the artwork to that one. So that's pretty cool. Like I said, it's really a fun hobby, and it's getting a lot of notoriety more that the comic movies come out and everything. And a lot of comic collectors are switching over to the artwork, because me personally being into it, but I think comic art is a way neater investment than comic books, unless you're into the really, really, really high-grade comics. But I think artwork is so much more fun. But they're both good, because you got to be a comic collector to get into the artwork first, you know.
Yeah, RomitaMan.com is the website. Again, it's up on GeekSpeakRadioShow.com. You guys can go on there and take a look at all of Mike's collection. Mike, thanks a lot for coming on and telling us about RomitaMan.com.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back anytime when you have any news or anything else you want to talk about.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Oh, and by the way, I saw Paranormal Activity over the weekend. It was a good movie.
See, there. It's unanimous. Everybody loved it.
Yeah. I always tell people you should see number one before you see number two. It'll help out, though.
Yeah. Although, like I was saying, this is sort of a prequel more than a sequel to the first one.
Exactly, exactly. Well, it's actually almost like a flash sideways because they technically happen at the same time. Interesting.
Yeah, so there you go.
But yeah,
Mike Berkey, he says so everybody go see Paranormal Activity 2 if you haven't seen it. So again, thanks, Mike, for coming on.
Okay, thanks so much.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So there you go. I see you're building your list over there.
Yeah, I wonder where he keeps all his artwork at. I mean, he must have like a vault or a warehouse.
Are you getting ideas?
No, but no, not like that. No, I'm not going to go and break in. No, I just mean as far as like, he must have like cases. I mean, like just, I mean, full with just this artwork. And I wonder, he probably has a lot of space in his house to store it somewhere. I mean, he got to. I mean, this stuff should belong in an art museum. It's just good.
Like Indiana Jones, you belong in a museum?
Yeah. It's great stuff, great artwork.
Yeah. And from a lot of the, some very legend for you and me, especially we're the Marvel guys. We're really into DC.
Yeah.
But for us, especially very iconic, very, for me, very, close to my heart stories, comic books that I remember.
And so what about covers that would one be for, I mean, for you? Would your, if you were to go to Romita Man and buy a piece, what would one that would, connect with you more?
All of them, quite honestly.
Really? Because for me, that's why I said Wolverine Limited Series issue number one, where Wolverine has his...
Well, because whenever I think of Spider-Man, and I've said it before, it's not the first time I admit this, Spider-Man has always been my favorite. When I think of Spider-Man, obviously, I think of Stan Lee and Ditko right away, because they're the ones that created it.
Yeah.
But to me, Spider-Man immediately brings up the name John Romita.
Yeah.
Those are the stories that I've actually... read a couple of the comic books that Mike was mentioning. I didn't keep them. I knew somebody who had them. I don't know what happened to them now, but I actually touched them in my hands. I was very careful. But besides touching them, I actually read through them and I love all the,
that's what, sucks about collecting comic books is you got to buy two in pairs, one to read and one to collect, to save and to keep its value. If you open it and read it, then you ruin its value. You know, you ruin its CGC universal grade as far as, you know, the numbering system where they go from one to two to see if it's, you don't know anything about collecting, but they go as far as the value of it would go down depending on the number from 0 to 10. So it's
we get that actually when we go to the comic book shops.
Yeah.
Some of the owners have told you don't let it drop because that devalues the resale price of the thing.
Yeah, that's why I got, you know, some issues of X-Men half the price because, you know, you see the marks where the corners were bent. And so I ended up saving me. I mean, I just want to read.
I think you did on purpose, didn't you?
No, I just want to read the story. I mean, but, you know, as for them, it's money.
Well, it was funny that he's calling you kid.
Right?
You don't look like a kid to me.
No, I'm not a kid. I'm maybe a big kid, but not a young one.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to take another break right now. When we come back, you ready to get scared again?
Yeah, of course. I'm always wanting to get scared.
A few weeks ago, we saw a view of San Francisco through Alfred Hitchcock's eyes.
Yeah.
Through the movies, at least.
Yeah.
Now, how about we go to actual haunted locations here in San Francisco?
Wow. That's I would love to go.
Okay. So, we're going to talk to somebody who wrote a book called Ghost Hunter's Guide to the San Francisco Bay Area. He wrote a lot of Ghost Hunter's books from all over the country, but we're going to talk, since we're here, specifically about this one. We'll mention some of his other books and stuff that he's working on, but definitely we'll mention everything here in San Francisco. So you and I, when we're done with the show, we can go and
go on an adventure.
Maybe get a paranormal activity of our own going.
Ooh, nice.
So when we come back, we'll do that. Don't go anywhere. Here's the Buzz Report.
This is the Geek Speak Radio Show Buzz Report for Monday, October 25th. Here's what's buzzing right now. Lots of potential spoilers in this report, so you've been warned. An article in the New York Times may have unintentionally given away a potential new character in Star Trek 2, or 12, whichever you prefer. The article talked about how Roberto Orci brings his iPad to production meetings and how on this particular meeting, he was showing slides from the first Star Trek film for possible locations, and then he came to a suggested actress to be cast in a new role. The interesting thing that the article points out is that Roberto Orci had used the iPad to sketch in Vulcan ears on this actress. Tom Hardy is confirmed for Batman 3, but it's not known who he will play. A rumor is gaining steam this morning that he will be playing Bane. Again, this is just a rumor, so don't go posting it on your Facebook or tweeting away. This month's Disney 23, a kids magazine published by Disney, has some more tidbits on Tron Legacy, including revealing that the original's director, Steve Lisberger, has a cameo as a bartender in the virtual nightclub. Marvel is putting the production of Runaways on hold. Runaways was a comic by Brian K. Vaughan and was rolling along smoothly with casting until Marvel decided that they have too many projects going on and that they want to put this one on hold to devote all of their attention to it at a later date. Due to scheduling conflicts, Captain America may be the first Marvel film without a Stan Lee cameo. The sequel to Korean monster film The Host will be shot in 3D. The script is still being written, but concept art stills will be shown at the Tokyo Film Festival happening this week. That's what's buzzing right now, and that's the Geek Speak Radio Show Buzz Report.
Geek Speak Radio Show will be right back.
You found the best place for quality internet talk. Around the clock and around the world. TalkZone.com.
back to the Geek Speak Radio Show on TalkZone.com. Here's Henry and Romo.
And we're back on the Geek Speak Radio Show. Ready to be scared again, young man?
Of course. I always love to be scared.
Nah, this one will hit closer to home, actually, because we're heard all over the world, really, on the internet also, but we're heard all over the country, but we are here. Our studios are here in San Francisco. So let's talk to an author who wrote a book entitled Ghost Hunter's Guide to the San Francisco Bay Area. These are actual haunted places.
Wow.
And you can imagine how many people are going to try it anyway, because this is the week for it anyway.
Of course, right?
But this is just, this is not an attraction, like the haunted houses that we've had, that we featured all month.
Yeah.
This isn't an attraction. These are real haunted places. They happen all year long, whether it's, Christmas, Easter, 4th of July, they'll be there.
Yeah, because I noticed that in the book itself, you mentioned Alcatraz Island, and I've been there. I'm not so haunted, but I know there's mysterious things that go on at night. So that's what I love about this book, Ghost Hunter's Guide to the San Francisco Bay Area.
Night. Yeah, so his name is Dr. Jeff Dwyer. He's a paranormal investigator and author now, of course, and he's on the phone line with us. Jeff, you there?
I'm here, Henry and Romo. Good afternoon.
How are you? Thanks for coming on the show.
I'm great. I'm always thrilled to talk about paranormal activity. I don't mean the movie.
Yeah, as are we. This has been a month-long celebration for us. This is definitely our favorite holiday.
Yeah, Halloween has become a season now. It's no longer just one day out of the year. And for paranormal investigations, Halloween is typically year-round for us.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, Jeff, actually, before we get into the books themselves, I was going to ask you, did you have any belief in the paranormal or any experience that you had before the age of 10? Because we're going to talk about that from your bio. But did you have any belief or anything before that?
No, I didn't. I wasn't aware of anything except for the typical ghost stories that you kids listen to around Halloween, things like that. It was only when I was about 10 I had my first experience. And then it was still slow for me to pick up on what was going on. I think I was around 16, 17 years old before I really started to collect ghost stories out of magazines and newspapers and start to think about it in a serious way.
What did you notice when you were 10 years old?
I was at the Brookdale Lodge in the Santa Cruz Mountains and saw an apparition come up over my left shoulder as I was looking into a stream. I thought it was my sister, because the apparition kind of looked like her in a way. But at that moment, my mother called to me from a plateau above the stream where I was located, and I looked up and saw my sister standing next to my mother. So within an instant, it's not possible for my sister, who was only about 6 at that time, to climb all the way up and stand next to my mother. So I realized I'd seen something. Didn't know what it was, really, although somebody that very day said there were ghosts around. Didn't think much of it, but then I realized that I'd seen something I can't really explain. It was a few years later that I got more stories about Brookdale Lodge. I realized I'd seen the ghost of Sarah Logan, who drowned in that stream when she was about 10 or 12 years old.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I've mentioned it before on the air, but I think I've seen some things myself, and that you don't see, it's not like in movies where you see the whole full apparition that's glowing. It's just a very fleeting glance. You think it's a shadow. You sometimes start to question yourself. Did I really see something? So that's when you probably know that, yeah, you did see something, right? Because
yeah.
It's not a full on, like I said, it's not like in the movies where you see a full on glowing apparition.
That's right.
Right,
in fact, most paranormal investigators have never seen an apparition. A few of us have. I think actually quite a few, and in almost every case they're partial. Very typically, it's from the knees up, it's transparent. Sometimes you'll see just the head and one arm, sometimes just one hand. But it's almost unheard of that you'll see something that's completely a full-bodied and lifelike apparition. Although I've seen two of those, I believe, in my lifetime.
Yeah, why do you think people are so, not obsessed, but just so interested in the paranormal and in ghosts? And not just around Halloween, just like you said, it's becoming like a year-long thing now.
It's a little hard to explain, and it actually surprises me that the paranormal has become so popular. You know, if you go back in time, you look back in the 80s, reincarnation was kind of the big thing at that time, and this followed on the heels of a minor spirituality movement that came out of the hippie era and the drug era of the 60s and the 70s. And that's just sort of an evolution. These days, I think people are interested in the paranormal because there's more and more evidence that there's something really to it. It's not just some sort of fabrication in someone's mind. And people are really curious about what goes on after we die.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's what it is. It's just that people just want hope that there's something to look forward to in the afterlife.
We like to believe there's something more than just being meat for the worms. You know, we'd like to think that there's a survivability of our consciousness or our soul, whichever you want to call it. And this offers people a lot of assurance that, you know, things are going to be okay.
Do you think the shows, you know, because like you mentioned, there's a lot of paranormal shows out there on television. Do you think those give paranormal investigations a bad name or make people not really take it that seriously?
Well, they've done a couple of things. They've stimulated a lot of interest in the paranormal, and out of that, some serious researchers and investigators have sort of come on the scene. But on the other hand, they do give us a bad rap sometimes because of various ways they go about their investigations. A lot of the shows that we see on TV use the instrumentation incorrectly, interpret the results incorrectly, and some of them, in order to make the shows more dramatic or more interesting, have a personality that's a little bit over the top, I think, and it turns off some of us in the paranormal community. But I guess it sells ratings, you know, to the shows.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was going to say, I've watched some of those, and because I've always been interested in the paranormal myself since I was young, but I've watched some of those, and that's exactly what turns me on, and I know I'm in the media myself, but I think of them as carnival barkers, like, hey, look, over here is this apparition, over here is this room, and that, like you said, just gives you a bad rap when the real paranormal investigators.
I think they have to dress it up sometimes because, after all, it is kind of tough to put on a show week after week where you actually display something that's paranormal, because in many cases, paranormal investigators have to go to a location several times before you pick up some credible evidence. And these shows can't afford to do that. You know, they go out and spend 3 or 4 days filming a show, and they've got to get something. And if they don't, or if it's really relatively minor evidence, they have to dress up the production to make it more interesting for people.
Yeah, I was going to say that the actual apparitions, they don't perform on cue. Like when you go to your, you know, the haunted houses that everybody puts on now, it's all, you know, electronically controlled. But real apparitions, they don't perform for you. They come out when they want to come out.
That's exactly right. In fact, most of the evidence that these shows present and the evidence that paranormal investigators present at conferences, most of it doesn't reveal an apparition. At best, sometimes they'll capture a shadow that's unexplainable in terms of photographic technique. But most of the evidence is audio. It's relatively easy to get audio evidence, and ghost hunters call this electronic voice phenomenon. And you
EVP,
go in with EVP, and you walk in with a digital recorder running, and you sort of invite the ghost to communicate with you. You ask them pointed questions based on research, and sometimes you get back some really fascinating responses. I listened to one over the weekend that was captured on Alcatraz not long ago. The San Francisco Ghost Society was out there, and they were in Al Capone's cell playing a recording of a song that Capone actually wrote while he was on Alcatraz. And at the end of the recording, they asked, Al, did you like the song? And a very rough voice is heard on the audio playback that says, yes, I did, you know, that kind of thing. And it's unmistakable. That's some sort of a ghostly response.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of EVPs myself. So again, we'll take a little break right now. We're talking to Dr. Jeff Dwyer. He's the author and paranormal investigator, the author of Ghost Hunter's Guide to the San Francisco Bay Area. We'll get into the books themselves in just a few minutes. So those of you who are here in San Francisco, get ready to go out there and maybe experience some things on your own.
The Geek Speak Radio Show will be right back.
All the talk, all the time. This is TalkZone.com. Internet Talk Radio. And now, more of the Geek Speak Radio Show on TalkZone.com. Here's Henry and Romo.
And we're back. Well, here's Henry, at least. Romo's under the counter there because he's scared. Quick note before we continue with Dr. Jeff Dwyer. Quick note from our last guest, Mike Berkey, RomitaMan.com. He is going to be featured on Sci-Fi's Hollywood Treasures. This will be on November 9th and November 24th. Check the listings for the exact time. Again, Mike's collection, you guys can see it, quote-unquote, live on Sci-Fi's Hollywood Treasures on November 9th and November 24th. And I'll get a listen and maybe put it up on GeekSpeakRadioShow.com. Right now, we are getting a look at Haunted San Francisco from Ghost Hunters Guide to San Francisco Bay Area author, Dr. Jeff Dwyer. So, Jeff, let's talk about the book itself. That was your first book, right?
Yes, it was. It came out in 2005.
Yeah, and I'm not going to ask what kind of research went into it because, you know, obviously you know what you're talking about. But what, besides the obvious, I think my co-host Romo, he mentioned Alcatraz. Besides the obvious ones that we think and know are haunted, what are some places that we wouldn't think are haunted that you mentioned in the book?
There's a place called the Neptune Society Columbarium up in San Francisco, up near the west side. And it's one of the last burial places in San Francisco. There are only three in the city. There used to be more than 40, but these cemeteries were moved around 1900 at the end of the bubonic plague epidemic. People don't know that San Francisco had a plague. It started in about 1898 and continued till about 1901. And it was feared that the bodies would continue the plague, so all the cemeteries but three were emptied. One is Mission Dolores, which is haunted. The other is the Presidio National Cemetery, which I've not heard that's haunted. But the final one is the Neptune Society Columbarium, which houses the remains of about 7,000 people. And apparitions have been spotted in this place, together with a lot of audio phenomenon. And the most commonly seen apparition is that of Viola von Staten, who was a little girl about 8 or 9 years old who died right after the 1906 earthquake because she drank tainted water. Most of the wells in San Francisco were tainted at that time, and she became sick and lingered for a couple of weeks and then finally died. But her apparition is seen just outside of the niche, which contains her ashes and the ashes of family members.
Yeah, I can imagine the Presidio is pretty haunted. I mean, every time you drive through there, you can it just feels different than the rest of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the San Francisco Art Institute up on Chestnut is also haunted. This building was constructed on one of the many cemeteries that was moved out of town, and apparitions have been spotted in the tower, mostly. And so it has nothing really to do with the art school itself. This is a case where a ghost occupies a structure that was constructed after its death. It's simply the structures on a site that was important to the ghost.
What made you want to write the book?
Well, I grew up in the Bay Area, and of course, since my teenage years, I just collected ghost stories and became more and more fascinated with it. And then not too many years ago, I was getting frustrated with getting my novels published, and somebody told me I should write something really strange. And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, ghosts are kind of strange. So I sat down and wrote the book, largely thinking I would simply pass it out to friends. But my literary agent got hold of it, sent it into a major publisher, and then they sent me back an 8-book contract. So I've been writing books ever since.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was the first one you wrote, but you had other ones in the Ghost Hunter series, right? Tell me about those.
Well, the second book was Los Angeles, which covers actually Santa Barbara down to San Diego. And then I wrote New Orleans. Although I'm a West Coast-oriented writer, I thought I would write about New Orleans because that's considered the mecca for ghost hunters.
Right.
I did that. And I've been down there several times since Katrina, and I found that the ghostly activity is still continuing down there. Then I wrote Seattle and the Puget Sound, and that was followed by the Wine Country book, which covers Napa, Sonoma, and Mendocino counties, and also a book about the Gold Rush country, which came out not too long ago. My most recent book came out in August, and it covers Monterey and the Central Coast, and that really extends from Half Moon Bay down to San Luis Obispo. And that was a lot of fun to write because I did a lot of surfing and scuba diving in the Monterey, Santa Cruz area for many, many years and still go down there quite often.
Yeah, and I have a link up to Jeff's website, jeffdwyer.com. I have it up on geekspeakradioshow.com. It has the links to all the books, and you guys can take a look at some of the excerpts on there. And, of course, go and buy the books if you so desire. So, Jeff, I was going to ask you, you told me about some of your experience, your personal paranormal experiences. Have you ever had anyone that you would consider dangerous or scary or that you just felt evil to you?
Yeah, I did. I was in the Alexandria Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, and this hotel was built in 1922, and it used to be the fanciest hotel in Southern California. And in fact, a lot of movie stars stayed there during the heyday of Hollywood. But of course, over the years, it became a typical downtown run-down hotel. And it's currently undergoing some sort of, you know, renovation. But I was down there investigating a crime scene. Apparently, a fellow went out a window on the 11th floor, went through the glass, went through a screen, and landed on a parking meter down on the street. And, of course, he died. And it wasn't clear whether this was a suicide or a murder. So I was there, and after the police cleared out of the area, I went up, and some evil power came up behind me and pushed me about 20 feet across this lobby on the 11th floor right towards that window. Now, there were 10 windows on this wall, but I went right towards the one that was still broken and the screen was torn. And it felt as though I was in the ocean and a wave had picked me up and moved me. And because of that that similarity, I simply recalled my days as a surfer and rolled off to the side perpendicular to the force and escaped it and left the floor. My impression was that there's some sort of evil power up there that might have pushed this fellow out the window, and I was lucky to escape. But that's the only time I've been really scared to the point where I feared for my life.
Right. And on your bio on the website, I also read that you've experienced not possession, but I forget exactly how you call it, but when a spirit passes through you. Tell me about that.
It's shared space, and there's a number of terms for it. It isn't possession. And it's a sensation that it's hard to explain, but it's very weird. It's like somebody else, something is inside you, and you almost feel a change in the perceptions you get from your body. I experienced this at the Coleman Mansion down in Menlo Park, and my associate Lloyd Auerbach has experienced this over in Moss Beach Distillery, which is over in Half Moon Bay. And it's a feeling that somebody else has occupied your space. Sometimes you feel very light, cold suddenly. Those two sensations occur together often. And people feel this sometimes and don't know what it is, but it's a ghost passing through your body. When I experienced it, the ghost actually remained within me for a period of time. And it was a strange sensation. And this particular ghost was female. And I don't know how to describe it, but I really felt my gender had changed.
Hmm. When that happens, can they control your actions or make you do something you don't want to do?
Not in the case of ghosts passing through you, no. And I'm not sure I believe in the idea of demonic possession. There's certainly a lot out there, and there's a tremendous amount of evidence within the historical records of the Catholic Church about demonic possession and exorcisms and things of that sort. And they believe that there can be demonic possession. But I think ghosts cannot make you do things that you don't want to do.
Yeah, and again, we're talking to Jeff Dwyer. He's the author of Ghost Hunter's Guide to the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as other Ghost Hunter's books. Again, it's all up on geekspeakbetashow.com. You guys can go on there, order the books, take a look around, and get to know more about Jeff, more than you're learning right now. You also had some paranormal experiences in a hospital, so tell us about those.
Yeah, hospitals are probably the most haunted location. They're very difficult to research, obviously, because of the high security that takes place in hospitals these days. But hospitals are full of paranormal activity, not only ghosts, but also what we call imprints. Imprints are laid down on the electromagnetic field of the environment by the intense repetitive emotions experienced by living people. And if you can imagine being in a hospital and lingering for days, knowing you're going to die, it's a tremendous emotional experience. And then that energy, if you will, is laid down on the environment, and sensitives who go into a room can pick up on that. And so hospitals are full of that kind of thing. This is a residual energy left not only by patients, but also grieving family members as well. And a lot of nurses, doctors, and others who work in hospitals often tell me about apparitions they see, cold spots they encounter and can't explain, or just a terrible feeling of grief, fear that they get when they go into a particular room in a hospital. So this is a sign, I think, of paranormal activity, not always ghosts. But there are a few hospitals you can go into. There's one in Los Angeles called Linda Vista Hospital that is was abandoned really in the late 80s because it's in a really bad part of town and doctors were being assaulted and one, in fact, was murdered in the parking lot. This hospital has been featured on some of the ghost shows like Ghost Adventures, and it's possible to get into to a tour of the place and do paranormal investigations. But I don't know any hospitals like that here in the Bay Area.
So Dr. Jeff Dwyer, paranormal investigator and author, one of the books is Ghost Hunter's Guide to the San Francisco Bay Area. Again, it's on the website, our website, geekspeakradioshow.com. You guys can go on there and buy it, get the books, learn more about Jeff, like I said. So, Jeff, thanks a lot for coming on and talking to us about your books and your experiences.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, and happy Halloween.
Thank you. Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So there you go. Now you know where to go, young man.
Yes, I do.
To really get scared.
I didn't even know that Angel Island was actually haunted. I've seen it, but wow, I really, you know, I know people that could camp there. So if I do go there, and I'm going to read this book and try to find what's haunting it.
So there you go. Thanks again today to Ross Carpelman from the House of Shock in New Orleans, Mike Berkey from RomitaMan.com. And again, he will be on the Sci-Fi's Hollywood Treasures on November 9th and November 24th. You want to see his collection on there. And Dr. Jeff Dwyer, who we just talked to tomorrow.
Yeah.
We will talk to, well, surprise. He's coming back tomorrow, same time, same bat channel, to quote your favorite TV show.
Yeah.
And you'll find out exactly what we're going to do. Or you can just go on geeksupergreatshow.com, look at the calendar and find out. So till tomorrow, bye-bye. Go get some treats, but we'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.